struggled with it, and his reflections on the shame he feels now for the fear and discomfort he experienced at the time gave the presentation a depth and resonance that stuck with me. At the end of the talk, Mark surprised us all by thanking Chris, who'd helped build the presentation and was sitting in the audience, unbeknownst to the crowd of Mausers. I got to shake Chris's hand and to hug Mark, my eyes still wet with tears. Conversely, during one of the company's most stressful and poor performance years, an incident fit almost too perfectly into the dysfunctional category. You'll recall from Chapter 10 the sexist manager we'd hired who was promoted several times but whose behavior was deeply poisonous and political. He was casually, but carefully, harassing young women who worked with or near him. And tragically, it was only after his tenure that I found out about the disparaging and inappropriate comments he'd made to these folks. When I separately asked two women who'd been on the receiving end of this behavior why they'd never brought it up with his managers or with HR, the answer was, because I didn't think anyone would care, and he's clearly getting promoted anyway. These women didn't feel safe pushing back against this manager, and they didn't feel safe bringing up the issue with the Moz HR team. So instead, the issue festered, with results that likely went far beyond those two recipients of his shitty behavior. Without the transparency of people who struggled with this guy's harmful speech or actions, his negativity spread like a cancer, amplified by the reactions and internalizations of people affected, hurting motivation and trust in hard-to-track-down ways. It's hard to make logical connections between these personal, emotional experiences and the output or quality of work at the company. Could it really be true that sharing stories of brain tumors and gender transitions, or accepting our children's sexuality, impacts the value our software delivers or the success of our marketing? Or that discomfort in sharing personal conflict or fear of retribution for speaking up about harassment could have negative impacts on those same outcomes? According to both the research and the anecdotal experiences, yes. When people work together, our performance is governed not by individual genius or singular outstanding contributions, but through complex interplay between the members of the group. Vulnerability and transparency in sharing our conflicts and concerns about work, about our teammates, and about our personal lives yields high-functioning, highly successful teams. When opacity, secrecy, discomfort, and fear exist, they can overwhelm even the smartest, most talented groups. Chapter 16. Self-awareness is a superpower. People love change when it's about changing others. People hate change when it's about changing themselves. That's Richie Norton, 2016. I don't waste time being depressed. If you're unhappy, you should change what you're doing. That's Mark Andreessen, April 1998. In September 2014, Brad Feld, our investor from the 2012 round, asked me to run Foundry Group's annual CEO summit in Denver, Colorado. I had stepped down as Moz's CEO 7 months earlier, but had, apparently, done a good job running the summit the year prior, and so they asked me again. I surveyed the portfolio CEOs about topics that warranted discussion, selected moderators and topics, created a schedule, and worked with Foundry staff on the logistics. The discussions were wide-ranging, from sales compensation to marketing tactics, engineering best practices, partnership opportunities, M&A, fundraising, and more. At the end of the day, all the CEOs were together in a large meeting room underneath the Renaissance Hotel, seated in a semicircle around Brad, who moderated the final session, titled Being the CEO, Personal Struggles, Work-Life Balance, and Emotional Health. Near the start of the session, Brad asked all the CEOs in the room to raise their hand if they had experienced severe anxiety, depression, or other emotional or mental disorders during their tenure as CEO. Every hand in the room went up, save two. At that moment, a sense of relief washed over me. So powerful, I almost cried in my chair. I thought I was alone. A frail, former CEO who'd lost his job because he couldn't handle the stress and pressure and caved into depression. But those hands in the air made me realize I was far from alone. I was, in fact, part of an overwhelming majority, at least among this group. That mental transition from loneliness and shame to a peer among equals forever changed the way I thought about depression and the stigma around mental disorders. I am not alone. Neither are you. For me, pinpointing the start of my depression is hard to do. I didn't know the signs or what to be aware of. I know that I exhibited at least some of the associated traits and tendencies as early as May 2013, but only came to recognize and call these symptoms depression, with the help of a therapist and coach, in the summer of 2014. My natural disposition is lightly introverted and introspective, but I function well in social settings and form friendships easily. If we met prior to 2013, you might use words like friendly, humorous, approachable, maybe even optimistic to describe me. But if we spent significant time together during my episode with depression, a very different picture would emerge. Most noticeably, I became an argumentative pessimist about work, convinced that nothing in my professional life or with Moz would or could go right. I berated my executive team, employees, investors, partners, and even customers about how badly we'd screwed up, how disappointed I was in everyone around me for letting us down, how any sign of positive progress was false and would soon be proven so. I'd speak at conferences about SEO or web marketing, as I have for many years, and at the end of my talk, there was often a line of people just off the stage, waiting to get questions answered or chat about some aspect of my presentation. My negativity ran so deep then that when folks would say kind things about Moz and tell me they'd been a subscriber for months or years, I'd spend a few minutes working to convince them that they should really switch to one of our competitors because our product was so shamefully behind this other tool due to some missing feature or inferior data set. Depressed Rand is arrogant. He's convinced that his dark view of the world is correct, and nothing anyone can say or do will change his mind. He's self-pitying, believing that the past decisions and mistakes he's made have created forces beyond his control that prevent any future progress or change. He wallows in misery, taking actual pleasure and happiness when things go wrong because it proves his predictions right. In perhaps the darkest twist of depression's grasp on my intellectual reasoning, I pointed those who'd question my negativity to research on depressive realism. Rachel Adelson described it in an article for the American Psychological Association's Science Watch like this. Psychologists have thought for decades that depressed people tend to distort the facts and view their lives more negatively than do non-depressed people. Yet, psychological studies have consistently revealed a peculiar exception to that pattern. Depressed people, studies indicated, judge their control of events more accurately than do non-depressed people. I cited this phenomenon to my coworkers, my board, even my wife. See, I'd say, I'm the one who can see things clearly, and I know that everything is unrecoverably awful. Depression affected me physically, too. I've had a herniated disc in my spine for many years. Seeing it on x-rays is particularly unnerving, no pun intended, as it makes my spinal column look like someone's taken a hammer and chisel to a crucial point near the base. That disc presses on the sciatic nerve that runs down my left leg. If I'm not religious about doing physical therapy exercises and using lumbar support when I sit down, I almost always carry a scarf to help with this, even on hot summer days, my leg will spasm and contract, causing sharp physical pain and trouble walking. During my depression, my leg, sciatica, and back issues were the worst they've ever been. I'd experience shooting pains, my ankle and calf locking up as every part of the muscle tensed uncontrollably. And sleep. Anyone who tells you it's a badge of honor to sacrifice sleep for work is full of it. The data's crystal clear. Less than 1% of human beings function effectively on less than 6 hours per night, and most of us need at least 7. I remember weeks on end where I was the most tired, worn out, poorly functioning version of myself I'd ever been. Barely able to keep my eyes open during meetings, tense, over-caffeinated, and quick to irrational anger. But when I'd climb into bed, the loop would begin. An awful circle of thoughts fixated on how much I'd messed up and how it could never be fixed and all the opportunities and wonderful things I and all the people around me would miss out on as a result. In the midst of that emotional anguish, I had conversations with Sarah Bird, my longtime chief operating officer, about her taking over as CEO someday. Sarah joined Moz in 2007, just after we'd raised our first funding round, ostensibly as chief counsel. We were much too small to need a full-time attorney on staff, but Sarah proved her value in all areas of the company. She is smart, flexible, willing to work as hard as need be to get projects finished, and she always puts the best interests of the organization above her own. Her clear, calm rationality balanced my own more manic and emotional approach to the business, and within a few months, we'd promoted her to Director of Operations, later to COO, and then in 2013, to COO and President. When my mom, Jillian, stepped off the board of directors after the 2012 funding round, we asked Sarah to take her place. I believed that Sarah could be a great operational CEO, and that Moz needed less of the vision and industry influencer-driven skill set I'd brought as we matured in our market. In November 2013, I had a phone call with Brad Feld, and we decided, together, to ask Sarah to step into the CEO role. I think Brad recognized that in my current state, I was not reflecting the qualities of leadership Moz needed. My depression had taken a toll on the team's morale, and my decisions and failures with Moz Analytics had led to our first growth rate slowdown in 7 years. Sarah accepted the position with humility, grace, and passion. In February 2014, she formally took over as Moz's CEO. I stepped into my current role as an individual contributor, working with product, engineering, and marketing teams in a consulting role. My depression continued, and although stepping down as CEO lessened some of the pressures and demands on my time, I quickly filled the gap with more conferences, content projects, and external work, helping a number of nonprofits and some of our fellow Foundry portfolio companies with pro bono SEO advice. That Valentine's Day, I, somewhat unintentionally, got very, very high. Seattle had recently legalized recreational marijuana, and some friends brought by a set of chocolate, pot-laced truffles. I ate one. It was tiny. I didn't feel much of anything, so I ate another. For the next 6 hours, I was mind-meltingly nervous and embarrassed. I couldn't talk to my friends, or even to Geraldine. I didn't want to move from my chair in our living room. I was incredibly thirsty, but so worried I'd spill water on myself and that everyone would laugh at me that I just stayed put, parched, staring at the clock and wondering why the minutes were taking so long to pass. The social event was less than ideal, but that night, I slept like the dead. I slept until 1 p.m. the next day, and the next two nights, I slept wonderfully again. My leg didn't hurt. My brain was quiet. I wasn't cycling on the loop of frustration and work problems. I felt free. The loop and the leg pain returned later that week as I reverted to my depressed state. But it was a looser hold than before. I now had an inkling that my obsession with problems at work, my sciatica, my lack of sleep, and that feeling of being trapped in the loop were all connected. If I could stop cycling on Maz's failures, on my failures, I could sleep, which would help my leg pain, which would make me feel better, which could lift my spirits and give me a more positive outlook for the future. That summer, I got progressively better. Maz did too. Under Sarah's leadership, we stopped the bleeding of subscribers from the dismal Maz Analytics launch, and the company began to grow again. A new product, Maz Local, launched and had success. We were hiring again. Things felt a little more stable, and I stepped back a bit more, refocusing on the things I was good at. Blogging, speaking, making presentations and videos, contributing to product strategy. I slept a bit better. My leg hurt a bit less. My negativity softened. Lifting the heaviest folds from my curtain of depression required something else. The catharsis of writing about it. The night before the Foundry CEO Summit in Denver, I authored a blog post titled, "A Long, Ugly Year of Depression That's Finally Fading." Writing that post and looking around the room filled with powerful, successful, venture-funded CEOs who openly admitted to their own emotional turmoil the next day was the tail end of an awful, soul-crushing journey that I hope never to revisit. I cannot tell you the cure for depression, nor do I have some secret formula for how to turn around a company spinning out of control. But I can tell you that we're not alone. And I can tell you that the path that worked for me, a path of self-awareness and active management of my mental health, has worked for others. It might work for you too. What's helped Maz and me, again and again, to find greater hope and a way forward is a process that doesn't attempt to reach a specific goal or have a finite endpoint. It's an ongoing journey, an investment, with steps repeated over and over again, all in the direction of self-awareness. Depression was a catalyst for me to seek professional therapy and professional coaching, something I hadn't done previously in my career. Brad referred me to Jerry Colonna, a coach who is well known in the startup world and had a prior career as a venture capital partner. He knows better than most the particular pressures and pains of entrepreneurship, and he's deeply empathetic to those whose emotional health affects others, as CEOs and founders almost always do. Jerry and I worked together for a little more than a year, scheduling once a month phone conversations to discuss work, personal life, and my fragile emotional state. From him, I learned a tremendous amount about managing one's own psychology and the reality of self-awareness. First and foremost, no one is self-aware. And equally, no founder is fully company-aware. Some of us are more self-knowledgeable than others. We understand a lot of what has impacted our emotional state in the past, what's driving our actions and our goals, why we hold the convictions and core beliefs we do, how our past, our upbringing, our experiences have shaped us, and what patterns, healthy and unhealthy, we fall into. Knowledge of these is on a spectrum. At the far end is my dad, an emotionally unstable man who can be deeply loving one minute and unhinged with anger the next, with no understanding of why or any conscious effort made to rein in his outbursts or seek help. On the other end is Jerry, deeply aware of what drives him, making time each day to analyze his actions and reactions. A researcher, studying himself as he studies others, always in pursuit of the next level, but never unsatisfied by a long journey to get there. To make progress on this spectrum, we have to be willing to accept that what we believe we know about ourselves may not be true. Have the courage to question our beliefs, and start from a place without pre-existing assumptions. I like how Dr. Jonathan Kumi phrases it in his blog post on intellectual honesty. Someone who is intellectually honest follows the facts wherever they may lead, and does so in spite of discomfort, inconvenience, or self-interest. Self-examination is rife with opportunities and incentives for bias. We want to believe the best about ourselves, and we know that many times, attacking pillars of our self-worth or our core beliefs sets off a vast minefield of psychological defenses. These are impediments we have to overcome. Easier said than done. The same applies when understanding the strengths and weaknesses of your entrepreneurial venture. You have hypotheses about why one tactic worked and another didn't. You blame some combination of market forces, or poor strategy, or too slow execution. But 9 times out of 10, you do it based on instinct and supposition, using those same biases that drive your blindness to self-knowledge. I know because I've been there. I started down the path of exploration with Jerry, confident that I was already self-aware. I started down the path of unraveling the lessons learned from Moz for our future, and for this book, and for my own sanity, with that same confidence. I knew what I wanted, a successful outcome for Moz via a large sale or IPO, and why, recognition, influence, wealth, the ability to give back. But when I stripped away my assumptions and the stories I've told myself all of my adult life and was truly intellectually honest, new stories emerged. Can I tell you something? I want Moz to have an exit. One that everyone talks about. There are lots of reasons, but what's most important to me? What would make me refuse to sell, even if every other condition were met? Secrecy. It's a highly unrealistic possibility, but if Moz had an amazing sale at a spectacular price, but one that no one could know about, that I could never write about, that no press outlet would cover or any blog post discuss, I'd resent that opacity so much, I might vote against the sale. I don't have high self-esteem. I have a serious case of imposter syndrome. I believe, deep down, that my career and my company might just be the result of accidental, undeserved success. I'm scared that I'll never be able to repeat it. And that's a big part of why I'm so scared to quit and start something new, despite all the opportunity and ideas and potential funders. Despite remarkable people who said they'd love to join whatever company I build next. What if I can't build anything else because I didn't really know how to build this one? That's why the public praise and the financial freedom and the checkmark in the created a successful company and took it to the finish line box matter so much. It's embarrassing to admit. I'm almost scared to let this book go to press with that paragraph in it. When you find a real truth about yourself, or a truth about your company, it's going to have that same feeling. The truths we hide about ourselves and our creations stay secret, because we bury them in layers of guilt and shame, of fear and self-loathing. But when you dig them up, reveal them, hold up the mirror, and scariest of all, when you admit them to the people they impact, your team, your family, your partner, or do so publicly, their shackles weaken and sometimes break altogether. The moment I admitted to myself that fear of being a fraud, fear of only having this one lucky accidental venture in me, were responsible for my biases, I was free. Today, I'd be okay with a secret exit I couldn't talk about. I think I'll be ready to start my next company too. Proving that I can do it matters to me. I'm the one who doubts myself. No one else's perception of Maz's outcome really matters, at least not along that factor. Pro tip. When you invest in behaviors based on your newfound knowledge, don't try to control the outcome, just the behavior. This holds equally true for your startup as for your emotional health. Because as much as we wish we could, we never have full control over outcomes. We own our behavior. And some of the time, hopefully often, the right behaviors lead to the outcomes we want. Recognizing this is crucial because many people and organizations reward outcomes rather than behavior. That can lead to punishing good behaviors if the outcome isn't the desired one, even if the forces were outside our control. And it can lead to reinforcing bad behaviors simply because they led to a good outcome. Again, even if the outcome was largely disconnected from the behavior. When I was depressed, I tried dozens of tactics in search of a solution. I tried exercising. I went to acupuncture. I did massage therapy. I tried craniosacral massage. It's kind of weird. I tried Chinese herbal medicines at the suggestion of my acupuncturist. I went to therapy. I took vacations. I took a night off each week from my computer, Friday night, in a recurring calendar event that still reads anti-work night. I did physical therapy and meditation and mindfulness apps. Every time I tried one of these and it didn't work, that is, I wasn't fully and immediately back to my old self within a few months, I'd give it up, assume it wasn't right for me, and try something else. I guarantee you've done the same thing, maybe in your attempts to lose weight, or in your dating life, or when you had to finish a big project, or help a loved one through a tough time, or build a company. Remember how growth hacks are almost always inferior to consistent investments in the right marketing channels and tactics for your strengths and your audience? The same principle applies to your life. It's almost never the case that you'll transform your personal psychology and manage your emotional and mental health long-term with a single or even a handful of hacks. The, I was depressed, but then I installed this great mindfulness app, and now I'm teaching my therapist how to live a happy life story goes right up there with, I was hooked on In-N-Out burgers and Pixie Sticks, couldn't program my way out of a Raspberry Pi, but I switched all my meals to Soylent, and now I'm a lean, mean, code-crushing machine. When you invest in a behavior, invest in just the behavior. Assess it based on its strengths and weaknesses, its costs and returns. Anti-work night didn't solve my depression, so I stopped doing it for more than 6 months. But when I had the revelation that behaviors trump outcomes, I brought it back. I did the same with physical therapy and exercise. I skipped the mindfulness app, the meditation, the acupuncture, and the herbal medicines. Likewise, at Moz, we've invested in behaviors we believe are healthy, even when they don't have consistently positive outcomes. Our approach to launching internal MVPs and iterating until they're earning praise and accolades from industry influencers has had great results for some projects and mediocre results for others, but we're investing in the behavior. Conversely, we found performance reviews to be a behavior that wasn't working for us, even though they could sometimes be connected to positive outcomes. What makes a behavior worthwhile is different for each person and each company, but almost all follow a few patterns. First, the behavior is, in and of itself, apart from any connected outcomes, rewarding and fulfilling. Second, the behavior fits with your core values. Third, the behavior can turn into a habit and, at least slowly, scales with decreasing friction. That is, it's easier to engage in the 30th time than the second. Fourth, the behavior has a positive, measurable, causal impact, even if it's small. Fifth, There is no clear causality between the behavior and a consistently negative outcome. The last key to behavioral investments is to reward the behavior, not the outcome. When I was fighting consciously against depression with the help of my therapist or my wife or my friends, it was the opposite of helpful to hear about a solution that would fix my issues. Why? Because every time I tried one of those solutions and it failed, I'd write it off, lose hope, and sink further into my malaise. In weight loss programs, this phenomenon is a constant problem. Diet and exercise work for a while, for some people, then they seem to stop working as the body fights tooth and nail against giving up any additional weight. Fat cells don't work the same way for everyone, and the more weight a person gains, the more their body resists normal caloric burn functions. Personal trainers and diet specialists and doctors, and worst, friends and family, blame a lack of willpower, but have no idea of the physical and mental struggle that constant, overwhelming hunger inflicts. In these cases, feelings of shame and failure are entirely counterproductive, as are goal-driven versus behavior-driven tracking. Rewarding weight loss, or fat-to-muscle ratio, is far less successful in long-term studies than recognizing and rewarding behavior. When we make it about the work rather than the goal, we find that outcomes improve. The field of behavioral science has all sorts of data on what happens when rewards are connected to outcomes rather than behaviors. Namely, people cheat, break rules, game systems, and ignore the safety of themselves and those around them. There is beauty and clarity in this truth. When we're freed from the mythology that we control outcomes and asked instead to concentrate on behaviors, we have a powerful tool to fight against negativity and anxiety. It's a gift. For me, it means freedom from the burden of fear I long associated with the potential return of my depression. For more than a year after my depression lifted, I was filled with dread that it could return. That fear stemmed from a lack of feeling in control. I didn't have a clear solution that worked instantly. Just a random event, the pot truffles, and a slow progression through trial and error that seemed to help. I felt vulnerable and insecure about my rediscovered mental health. But focusing on behaviors gives me clarity and control. It lifts my burden from things I can't perfectly influence, the reality that someday I might have depression again, to things I can. Diet, exercise, physical therapy, investment in self-awareness as an ongoing process, breaks from work, self-forgiveness. This is where the power to combat negativity resides. When we understand ourselves and our creations, we understand what influences decisions, behaviors, and outcomes. We then make the conscious choice to put effort into learning from our past decisions, not letting our biases control us, and investing in better behaviors. Simultaneously, we choose not to reward outcomes, but rather to use them only as a part of our analytics and decisions about where and whether to reward or discard a behavior. We have the power to change the ways we react and the way things make us feel. As my cousin-in-law Yvonne, a therapist, likes to say, feelings are not facts. The same goes for strategy, even for vision. These are malleable things within our control. Chapter 17. Focus. I knew that if I failed, I wouldn't regret that. But I knew the one thing I might regret is not trying. That's Jeff Bezos, 2016. The most awful day Moz ever experienced was, without question, August 17th, 2016. That morning, our CEO, Sarah, stood on stage in front of the company and announced that we'd lay off 59 of our 210 full-time employees, shut down two fledgling products, and cease pursuit of the strategy we'd followed for the prior 2.5 years. There were tears and anger, nasty write-ups about the company on blogs, review sites, and social media, lost friendships, lost trust, and lost reputation. Worst of all was that this news came as a complete surprise to most of our team. Of all the missteps and poor decisions, the one I regret most is the lack of transparency our leadership team, myself among them, showed in the months leading up to that event. What happened? How did Moz go from 100% year-over-year growth for 7 years in a row to repeated missteps and missed budgets resulting in eventual layoffs? How did we go from announcing and believing that everything was fine just 3 months prior to those layoffs to determining that they were critical to the company's survival? How did we miss the mounting evidence of structural weaknesses in a part of our business until such a late hour? I believe the answer to all of these was a lack of focus. One of the many foolish beliefs I held after raising capital, especially our $18 million round in 2012, was that we were now obligated to spend that money quickly to find additional growth. This is one of the worst, most pervasive myths in the startup world, and sometimes your investors reinforce it or even heavily lobby for it. Mine didn't. Brad and Michelle both felt that Moz was doing wonderfully well. Brad told me in a 2013 email that Moz was one of the best performing companies in Foundry's portfolio. But they supported my vision of going broader and accelerating Moz's already strong growth rate. To achieve that growth, I thought I had to try everything. A broader product suite, a range of acquisitions, some totally new products and markets, all sorts of new internal programs. I believed we had infinite capacity, and the only limit was our imaginations and drive. Well, that and the money in the bank. But if we spent it, there'd always be more VC so long as we found more growth. But this is magical thinking. What I really did was divert attention away from the few things that kept the lights on. Big mistake. The SEO world is not enough. Back in 2011, while CEO, I'd shifted Moz from our focus on exclusively SEO software that helped marketers with rankings and traffic from search engines to a broader set of tools that would assist with other interconnected channels like social media, press and public relations, and content marketing. Moz Analytics had tried to tackle all these different channels with tragic results. Thankfully, we still had plenty of cash in the bank, and with the exception of a few months in early 2014, we continued to grow revenue, albeit at a slower pace. But we also maintained course on that broader suite of functions, rather than focusing back on SEO. The new strategy we implemented when Sarah took over the CEO role was an attempt to follow in the footsteps of companies like Atlassian, makers of numerous software tools including HipChat, Jira, Confluence, StatusPage, and more, Microsoft, and 37 Signals, makers of Basecamp, Campfire, and HiRise, three separate products serving various unique project and process management functions. Ironically, 37 Signals, one of the models for our multi-product strategy, closed down all but one of their products in 2014 in order to focus. Founder Jason Fried wrote about it on Inc.com. These companies had successfully expanded from their core product into multi-product suites that serve different but overlapping audiences, and we thought we could do the same. Together with our board of directors, Sarah and I worried that investing exclusively in SEO could limit the company's potential for growth. We were nervous that if something happened to the field of SEO and we couldn't react quickly or well enough, we could be in big trouble. We felt that the overlap in marketing practices meant that many people who knew of, visited, and trusted Moz were strong customer targets for us, no matter their actual roles. We had perhaps too much confidence in our ability to build and launch new products in new fields, and even more overconfidence in our brand and marketing abilities, sure that the Moz name plus any semi-decent product reaching our millions of monthly website visitors would sell. All of these hypotheses sound compelling at face value. Fear that growth in a product line may have tapped out isn't unusual. Companies worried about putting all their eggs in one basket isn't either. Confidence in your strengths based on past performance sounds reasonable too. I don't think any of these were foolhardy, unprecedented, amateur concerns or decision-making criteria. It's just that none of them could, or should, overwhelm the drawbacks that multiple investments in different products, markets, and audiences have. For us, the multi-product strategy started with a product called Moz Local, which helps small local businesses and large companies with many hundreds or thousands of physical locations to get their location data easily and accurately into all of the many directories and networks that people and search engines used. Moz Local started as the brainchild of David Mim, under the name Get Listed. David's company was one of our early acquisitions after the 2012 funding round, and together with a small team of ex-Google engineers, they designed and built a remarkably useful tool. If, for example, you owned a gelato shop and wanted to earn visibility on the web, you had to figure out, A, what are all the search engines, websites, and apps that potential customers might use? B, what sources power all of those? C, who do I have to pay, how often, and how much to get that information correctly included? And D, what do I do if the information needs updating? David had worked with local business owners for a decade, helping them through these challenging processes. Those owners knew that wrong hours on Google Maps, not being listed in Yelp, not ranking in search engine results, or appearing in the wrong category on TripAdvisor could cost them customers. And in the local business world, just a few customers a month can mean the difference between survival and bankruptcy. With Moz Local, you could put your hours, website, address, phone number, and other important details into the tool once and have it propagate that data to consumer sites like Foursquare, Yelp, TripAdvisor, Yellow Pages, Bing Maps, and Google Maps, as well as listing aggregators such as Axiom, Infogroup, Factual, and Localese, whom Google, Bing, Apple, and others use to validate or verify local information. Moz built relationships with all the various providers so that customers could pay us once, $99 a year, and we'd pay all those third parties on their behalf when submitting the data. Our raw costs were around half that amount, thanks to buying large deals upfront in bulk. As the gelato shop owner, not only did you get correct data on all these sites and listing sources, but you'd also usually see higher rankings in local searches on Google and Bing due to how those search engines give benefit to listing consistency and coverage. In 2014, we had two primary products, Moz Pro, our longtime tool set for professional marketers doing SEO, and Moz Local, for local or physical businesses to add or update their location information across the web, as well as two secondary products, MozCon, our annual customer conference in Seattle, and the Moz API, where developers and tool makers could buy large-scale access to our raw data. The next addition to our suite was a Twitter analytics tool called Follower Wonk. Like Moz Local, we'd acquired the company back in 2012. Based in Portland, Follower Wonk was a tool for searching the biographies of Twitter accounts and analyzing activity, engagement, and followers. We'd heard about it from numerous influencers in the SEO world who used the tool to help build relationships, better understand their audiences, and optimize their Twitter activity to help grow their followings. When we bought the company, we wrapped the product into the Moz Pro suite such that you had to buy Moz Pro to get access to Follower Wonk. we grandfathered in the handful of historic customers and hoped that the combination of the SEO and social media functions would help marketers in both camps. Unfortunately, we discovered that despite the recommendations and endorsements from prominent SEOs, the overlap between marketers doing SEO work and those who also worked on social media marketing via Twitter was in practice very small. Less than 5% of the more than 25,000 Moz Pro subscribers used Follower Wonk in a given month. And a similarly small percentage of Follower Wonk customers and those who'd signed up for the product via Moz Pro used any part of our SEO tools. Thus, in 2015, 3 years after we'd integrated the products, we broke Follower Wonk back out into its own subscription. Customers could once again purchase Follower Wonk independently. Next, we added Moz Content, a product based on a section of the Moz Analytics tool suite we'd never finished, designed to serve content marketers. Our goal was to help websites regularly publishing content to attract visitors and turn them into customers understand which pieces of content were working best, suggest potential topics, conduct a content audit of their sites, and give them metrics to compare themselves to the competition. Moz Content took a little more than a year to design, build, test, and launch. It had a private beta in November 2015 and became publicly available the following January. Last was Keyword Explorer, a keyword research tool, the one I described at the end of Chapter 12, and part of the Moz Pro suite, but also available separately via its own subscription. As of mid-2016, Moz had four primary products, Moz Pro, Moz Local, Follower Wonk, and Moz Content. We had two conferences, MozCon and MozCon Local, launched in 2015 to support the local product's unique and growing audience. And we had two secondary products, the separately available Keyword Explorer and the Moz API. It turns out, selling eight different things to people visiting your website is vastly more challenging than selling two or three. It's nightmarishly harder than selling one. And, perhaps obviously, it's much harder to structure teams within a company to support eight unique products. Even with a much larger staff, we were spread thin. Every product and engineering team expressed the anger and frustration of being understaffed. Marketing was overwhelmed trying to keep up with competing requests for promotional space on the site, emails to our audience, social media promotions, etc. Infrastructure teams like design, finance, operations, legal, and HR all struggled to keep up with the demands of these multiple teams with unique products, all vying for attention and support. Every team wanted to hire, and for most of 2014 and 2015, our budget was crafted to enable significant headcount growth. We went from about 125 people at the start of 2014 to more than 220 2 years later. In June 2016, I had a scheduled lunch with Moz's CFO, Glenn. It was a beautiful Seattle summer day, so we walked a dozen blocks to a Neapolitan-style pizzeria south of Moz's offices. On that walk, Glenn asked me, in his hallmark, non-sequitur way, whether Moz had ever done layoffs in the past. "No," I replied. "We've never even had to consider it." Despite being a venture-backed business, where risk-taking is encouraged and scaling up and down is the norm, Moz had historically been run profitably, or close to break-even, with two exceptions, the first following our 2012 fundraising, when we acquired three companies, opened a second office in Portland, built out our own private data center to move off Amazon's cloud services, and grew staff significantly. And late 2014 to mid-2016, when we chose to invest in the multi-product strategy. Glenn and I spent that lunch talking almost exclusively about his concerns with our declining growth rate and burgeoning budget. Unfortunately, Glenn was preaching to the already converted. I was obsessed with returning to profitability, and had been since late 2013. That November, I'd made a poorly timed proposition to my team. I would grow my mustache out until the company returned to being cash flow break-even or better. When I stepped down as CEO 3 months later, I no longer controlled that decision. And Sarah both liked the mustache, I maintained she didn't have to worry about waxing it or how ridiculous it looked on blustery, high humidity days, and believed that Moz should forego profits and, as most VC-backed companies do, spend more to get faster growth. Careful to avoid getting cheese and pizza sauce in my now ridiculous facial hair, seriously, it curled in giant loops up to my nostrils. I explained my position to Glenn, though he'd heard it plenty of times before. I think he was conveying to me that I had a new ally on my side, and that he, too, felt it was wise for Moz to scale back its spending. Understanding revenue and expenses effectively was much harder in the new, more complex, more diverse world of 8 revenue sources. Those products had different models, different cash flow issues. Moz Local, for example, paid out its listing costs as soon as a transaction was made, but then recognized revenue over a year, while Moz Pro collected and recognized most transactions monthly. Each product was growing in revenue, but none of them was meeting the projections submitted in December of the prior year for the official board-approved budget. Over the next month, Glenn and Sarah worked with the leadership of each of the Moz products to revise their budgets and understand the cash flow implications. When that process was completed, and when June's numbers were put into the projection models, we knew there was a reckoning ahead. Sarah had booked a 2-day executive team offsite retreat August 1st and 2nd. She and Glenn presented slides showing that our financial position was weakening, and that because we'd invested so heavily in personnel to support the multi-product efforts, we'd need to accelerate revenue growth dramatically to avoid burning through our remaining cash reserves. We talked briefly about what had gone wrong to bring us to this dark place, but the answer was both simple and unsatisfying. We'd risk-modeled the possibilities that several of our products might miss projections, but were caught wholly by surprise when every product missed. Looking back over the last few years of product growth rates, there was an uncanny correlation, as if each new product we added to the mix subtracted a little from the growth of every other product we offered. On reflection and after analysis, I believe this was no coincidence. It was clear that major change was required. We needed a sizable injection of cash, a dramatic reduction in costs, or a huge improvement in growth rate to avoid burning more cash than we could afford. The projections showed that on the current course, we had about 12 months of operating cash remaining. That was an unacceptable level of risk to all of us. Cutting staff seemed unavoidable, but Sarah and Glenn needed time to draw up plans and evaluate scenarios. At the end of the day, Sarah listed a few ideas on an easel pad, possible product futures for Moz. They included options like 1. Turn the pro subscription into a cash cow, meaning we eliminate much of its staff and marketing and let its profitability fund other parts of the business. 2. Combine Moz content and follower wonk into a single product for influencer marketing. 3. Sell the pro business and use the proceeds to fund other products. 4. Shut down all products except pro. 5. Shut down all products except pro and local. 6. Shut down Moz content, sell follower wonk, focus on pro and local. And 7. Focus only on self-service pro and local, eliminate enterprise, wonk, and content. Each option would mean significant staff cuts in order to extend our runway or reach profitability. The executives around the table knew it. Several of them volunteered to be laid off, myself included. My offer was declined, but our CMO and 2 other executives were let go in the RIF, reduction in force, that followed. The downside of high-margin software businesses like ours is that when you need to save money, people are often the only resource to cut. An average Moz employee costs the company about $145,000 per year. That includes salary, benefits, taxes, insurance, etc. Cutting back on expensed software subscriptions, office expenses, travel and entertainment budgets, conferences, sponsorships, and hardware would all be part of the equation, but none of them could impact the bottom line to the necessary degree. We would need to do the company's first ever round of major layoffs. Layoffs are every founder's worst nightmare. Not only are they a demoralizing, soul-crushing experience, doubly so for those laid off, they often precipitate the beginning of the end. It's a rare startup indeed that can come back from layoffs with the same leadership team and turn the business into a success story. The odds aren't hopeless, but they're certainly not in your favor. The 7-hour board meeting. The following Wednesday, August 10th, we'd scheduled 3 hours for Moz's board of directors to meet. The meeting ended up going 7 hours. One of our directors had to rebook his flight. Everyone missed their dinner plans. The atmosphere of that meeting was intense, but it was direct, honest, and collegial. Well, up until the end. We all knew that everyone in the room had made mistakes. We'd accepted overly optimistic projections, built budgets that didn't account for potential missteps, and made prideful assumptions about what the business could accomplish, despite being spread so thin across so many projects and products. Moz's board comprises Rand, author of this book you're listening to, founder, ex-CEO, individual contributor at Moz, board chairperson. Sarah Bird, Moz's CEO. Michelle Goldberg, Moz's first investor from Ignition Partners. Seth Levine, partner at Foundry Group. Seth took over Brad Feld's board seat in January 2016, a rotation that's pretty typical for Foundry's partners, though I was immensely sad to lose Brad, with whom I'd always had a special bond. Thankfully, in 2017, he and Seth swapped again. Matt Blumberg, independent board member, founder and CEO of ReturnPath. Julie Sandler, principal at Madrona Venture Group at the time, observer. Madrona bought some secondary shares from Jillian, my mom and Moz's co-founder, and we love Julie's input, so we ask her to attend whenever possible. Kelly Smith, investor with Curious Office in Moz's 2007 funding round, observer. Kelly wasn't in attendance, but contributed some thoughts via email. A typical board meeting for us also includes time with the members of Moz's executive team. But this time, given the sensitivity of topics and need for focused discussion, Sarah opted to make it board members only. The board's discussion covered these 5 items in order. 1. What product mix is right for Moz going forward? 2. What does the market look like for M&A, private equity, and or additional venture funding? 3. What cuts do we have to make? How deep is deep enough? 4. Should we work to sell off any of our products or simply shut them down? And 5. How should we approach and manage an RIF process? We spent a lot of time discussing the market and exit scenarios. Our investors, as patient as they are and have been, have time horizons to meet. Their LPs expect returns within about 10 years, and Moz will likely be at the outer limit of that range. Hence, the big question we had to ask was, what mix of products and strategy did we believe would give Moz the best chance to be IPO ready in the next 3 to 4 years? It's not that we didn't or wouldn't consider an acquisition, but rather that we had the shared belief that aiming for IPO is the best way to maximize the opportunity for an acquisition, whereas intentionally targeting a particular company or a set of companies who'd hopefully buy Moz is both riskier and vastly less motivating for our team. The answer we eventually agreed upon was a refocus on SEO, helping organizations of all sizes get found in the non-paid results of search engines. I challenged everyone very specifically on this topic, asking whether our board members really believed 1. that SEO was a protocol, like email or social or content, and would garner ongoing investment from businesses for years to come. 2, that the market